then say, if in Jesus the fullness of God exists and dwells, then what does Mark tell us God is like? The class would then begin to rewrite this list that they had made. This is what God is like from Mark's gospel. And Willman would say that time and time again, he was amazed at how different these lists were. Not that they were completely unique, but that they were very different just generally. And he said, it's amazing what this exercise would reveal. It's amazing how much of our thinking about God, our ideas about who God is, don't come from God's word, but are actually just ideas or thoughts that come from other places that we sort of bring in and apply to God, assume must be true about God. The other thing he would say is that it's amazing how loosely we link God and Jesus. So that we see Jesus and we think about him as someone who came to do something really important for God. But we don't look at Jesus and think, ooh, Jesus, these are the very characteristics of God. Like the heart of Jesus is the heart of God. What Jesus does, this is what God does. As I heard Willman talking about this, one of the most obvious ways for me that this sort of plays itself out is when we talk about power. My sense is that we love to talk about God's power. That we're pretty nearly obsessed with signs of God's power. But when we look at Jesus, we see someone who interacts with power in ways that do not make sense to us. We see someone who chooses not to do things that he could do. And sometimes Jesus is even incapable of doing certain things. In Jesus, we find somebody who limits his own power, who sometimes refuses to use power, who regularly misuses power, at least according to my belief in how he should use it, right? Using it for, not for himself, but for the sake of like others and the powerless. We don't love to talk as much about what Jesus does with power. We aren't nearly as obsessed with seeing signs of God limiting his own power or refusing to use his power. In fact, these tend to make us really uncomfortable. When we think God should intervene and act powerfully and he doesn't, this makes us go, what is God doing? Why isn't he doing what I think he should do? And this all affects the way that we see the world that we live in. When our leaders apologize to our enemies, we call this weakness. And then when our leaders boast and brag, we call it strength. We expect our leaders to be strong because strength is probably one of our favorite high places to worship at. We've been worshiping at the temple of strength since we were kids. Strength and power have a firm foundation in our hearts. We honor strength and power. We worship it. And so, the importance of Advent. Think about what people usually create holidays for. We overcame a powerful oppressor, and so let's celebrate our mighty Independence Day. This powerful general led us to victory, so let's remember his strength and courage on this day. Or what about our powerful leader who brought us into this new era of prosperity and strength? Let's honor him with a day. The days that a nation sets apart as holy or as sacred are almost entirely days designed to reflect on power. And then the church comes along and says, we'd like to set aside these 4 weeks of the year to help us understand why God would choose to enter the world through a poor virgin girl on the outskirts of an empire. We want to understand why God took on himself the vulnerable flesh of humanity. Philippians describes it this way. It says, God empties himself, taking the form of a lowly servant, being born in the likeness of humans. So why does the church set aside 4 weeks of our year, every year, for this story? I mean, right, how many different ways can we really say God became a man? I should be a little bit more honest about the way that the church sort of observes Advent. Because historically, like through centuries and globally around most of the world, the church practices Advent. But not all local congregations, and especially in the United States, not all local congregations are really willing to give up these 4 weeks of our year to reflect on the coming of Jesus. There's a really practical reason for ignoring Advent. And that is that Advent is really impractical. Surveys continue to tell church leaders that all over America, a large number of people go to churches looking for comfort or advice, looking for inspiration or direction. So that people largely evaluate sermons and services on whether they were moved or not, whether they found the sermon useful or not. And so many pastors feel that Advent is kind of a wasted season. At least if we focus on the Advent stories. Because these stories are often really unsettling. Have you noticed that as you have been reading them through the week? So that, like, if people are moved by these stories or by sermons, it's often in, like, really uncomfortable ways. But more often, people are bored or unmoved by these stories. And part of that is because they are so stinking strange. But more than that, these stories are incredibly, intensely impractical. Right? None of us are priests like Zechariah ministering to the Lord in the temple where he, like, shows up with this glorious angel. And none of us are likely to give birth to the Son of God anytime soon. I'm going to guess. And so we treat these stories like really precious trinkets. Like we put them on our shelves so that periodically we look at them and we admire them. We like having them around, but since we don't really know how to use them, like they don't seem very useful to us, we just give them a place of honor on our shelves, but we don't truly treasure them in our hearts in a way that changes who we are. The stories of Advent are impractical, but we confess they are deeply true. So that Advent then helps to train us to understand the truth about God. And if we will let it, Advent will train our imaginations to see the world that God sees it. And we desperately need God to retrain us. It reminds me of a conversation that I had just last night with Jay. This time I actually asked him for permission to share. So there's growth here. Jay and I have run a bit together over the last few months. And a few weeks ago, Jay went out and did he just hide? I was like, he was just there. a few weeks ago, he ran 6 or 7 miles. It was something like that. And then just this last week, Jay ran a 5K under 8 minutes per mile. To put this in perspective, Jay and I ran a 5K several years ago with several other dads, and Jay explicitly said this to me: I am not a runner. Since then, when he told me he's not a runner, he's also told me that he would never be able to run more than 5 miles, and he also was completely convinced he would never run faster than a 9-minute 5K. I've asked him to run a half marathon with me probably a dozen times in the last several months, and every time he says this: I could never do that. So now that he's done both of these things, run more than 5 miles, run a 5K under 9 minutes, turns out the limits in his brain are beginning to expand. His imagination is growing. So that last night, he said, and this was just in passing, as if it were nothing, that yeah, I could probably run a half marathon. I immediately stopped because of how many times he said, I could never do that. See, because it didn't matter how many times I told him you could run a half. He had to deliberately train his mind, his heart, and his body to accept that reality. The truth that I was speaking to him was such a foreign idea that it needed to be worked into him in a deep and profound way that took time. The truth that I had spoke to Jay that he could run a half marathon, turns out not once did it like move him or inspire him, right? Like, you could run a half marathon. No, right? That's the extent of the response I got. And it was also really impractical truth for him, because you could run a half marathon. No. Right? It didn't change the way that he lived in any way, that he couldn't apply that to his life in some like way of training, because he was convinced he couldn't. The truth made no difference for him until his mental limits expanded and he accepted it as truth. Then and only then could he decide to do something with it. And now he might just say, nah, I don't want to, right? But that's a very different response. In our passage this morning, there is a powerful line that captures this sentiment. We heard it this morning. The angel Gabriel says to Mary, "For nothing will be impossible with God." And I love what this implies. Everything that we think impossible, everything that we think is impossible, is merely a boundary or a limit in our brains. Consider pregnancy, the heart of these passages. I mean, one of the most common things in life is pregnancy. Every single human being that exists exists because someone was pregnant. And in every day and in every age, we think we know what is possible regarding pregnancy. And in the first chapter of Luke, God takes one of the most normal, natural, and understood experiences in life, and he just explodes our imaginations. Now, this isn't technically the first time that God has given a baby to a couple well past childbearing years, when he does it for Zechariah and Elizabeth, but it's rare enough in scripture, right, that this isn't like normal. It exists as an exception to the rule. A reminder that God is not limited to the boundaries of pregnancy. Through Zechariah and Elizabeth, then, God reminds his people that he is the God of life, and age is no limit to him. This is a familiar lesson from the First Testament. But it's a lesson that we need to hear in this moment to prepare us to hear what's about to be said next. This is where our brains explode. Pregnancy, in every case ever in the history of humanity, has required two human participants or contributors, right? Male and female, two become one flesh, like in the most literal way possible. There is one new creation that comes together. Baby making requires the contribution of two people. This is the way the world works. It is the only way the world works. This is the boundary of human imagination. Until God blows up that boundary and a woman by herself with no contribution from a man is pregnant. And we begin to wonder, like, what else might be possible? For nothing is impossible with God. I don't know where you start to go the moment you like try to imagine the impossible things that God might want to do. I tend to go big. World peace big, right? Cancer disappears big. Racism just ends big, and so on, right? The big stuff is just gone. And that's where these Advent stories keep doing their work in me, calling me to understand who God is and what he's doing. Because Mary, giving birth to a baby, is almost entirely unseen and unnoticed by anyone. It's almost entirely misunderstood by everyone, and it appears impossibly insignificant. I tend to associate God doing the impossible with great acts of power. So when I think about the solutions, God making the impossible possible with world peace, like I think of groups like ISIS or the KKK, these religiously motivated terrorists, right? And it feels impossible that they would ever be gone, that they would ever just disappear and that we'd be like over them. Though when I read this and I'm reminded that God does the impossible, I start to find myself gaining some confidence. And I go, no, God could wipe out ISIS. God could eliminate the KKK. And then I realize my answer to the impossible is to imagine more power or a greater power winning. Right? In my imagination, more power always wins. I have a small imagination. My answer to the impossible, my best answer to the impossible, is an answer that comes from the realm of my possibility. To say that another way, my answers to the impossible always come from my own understanding of what I've seen, of what I've experienced, of what I know to be true and possible. That's insane, right? We already decided that it's impossible. So how could something from my realm of possibility overcome? It's nuts. And that's the way that we tend to move at how God should answer the issues that we have. And this is what makes Mary so significant to me. By the time this is all over, God giving Mary a baby is going to look like child's play compared to what he has accomplished. I mean, Mary is as vulnerable a human being as you could get in first century Palestine. A young girl who essentially becomes an object of public shame by having a child out of marriage. And more than that, all anyone knows is that she's a lawbreaker. She is an adulterer. Now we know, because we've read the story, that she's innocent of adultery, but nobody else knows that. And there is no proof, no evidence. What is she gonna say? An angel told me. Men, especially men with power, have a tendency to respond harshly when they have been embarrassed or shamed. And so her family, led by a man, could easily respond by abandoning her. Joseph, the man that she is engaged to marry, could easily abandon her. To be a young girl in this society was already a vulnerable position, but God seems to like load her up with vulnerability and push her to the edge. Mary has no power whatsoever. And it's Mary that God uses to give birth to a king whose kingdom will go on forever. God's answer to the impossible isn't to produce a power greater than anything we've seen. It's the opposite of that. God's answer is to take the weakest and most vulnerable and to plant her in a harsh world and through her bring hope and life and beauty to bring a new kingdom, a kingdom the size of a mustard seed. I referenced ISIS and the KKK earlier because I think they actually provide us a helpful analogy to the world that Mary lived in and the world that that had defined Israel for so many years. Last week, we were told that all of this, these stories about the coming of Jesus, takes place in a world where Herod is king. And I know many of you know about Herod, and Herod's like one of my favorite people to bring up every year around Christmas because he is the opposite of Jesus, right? In so many ways. Herod is not a legitimate king of Israel. His rule, his reign is built on lies. His rule is built on distortions of the Jewish faith and tradition. But mostly his rule is just built on power. But Herod isn't the first king of Israel to rule in this way. It's not like he's just making this up. And this week, as you worship together in your households, reading through this story and the story in 2 Kings 21, you read the story of Herod's mentor. Almost 700 years earlier, a king named Manasseh began to reign as king. And he was 12 years old when he began to reign, about the exact same age that most scholars assume Mary was when she became pregnant with Jesus. But that is the only thing Mary and Manasseh have in common, where Mary offers herself to the Lord as a servant, eager to do his will. I mean, Manasseh does everything he can to destroy and thwart God's will, to destroy God's kingdom, to destroy the people that God made. We're told that Manasseh was worse than any king that had ever reigned in Israel, which, as we've been reading Kings together over the last several months, like, we're talking really bad here. But he goes further than just like, yeah, I'm the worst king Israel's ever had. We're told that his sin exceeded the sins of the people who lived in the land before Israel was brought in by God. Like, this was supposedly the reason they were kicked out and Israel was given the land. And now Manasseh has led the people into even greater sin. And there's this powerful line in the story of Manasseh that for me, like, captures, like, his spirit, who he was, what he was about. The story of Manasseh in 2 Kings 21, verse 16. We're told this. Manasseh shed very much innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem with from one end to another. Besides the sin that he made Judah to sin so that they did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So he leads all of Judah into this false worship around false gods. But more than that, he slaughters the innocent people who he had been entrusted to serve and care for. This is key. Manasseh oversaw incredible injustice. Innocent life was taken. According to the prophets, this meant a number of things. On one hand, we're talking innocent life like women and children and orphans and widows. But innocent life also had a technical definition. We could be talking about those who were executed unfairly without a fair trial or without sufficient evidence against them. Perhaps like a young woman who had been found to be pregnant before marriage, with no evidence to prove her guilt, but also no evidence to prove her innocence. Mary is the exact sort of person who would have been as vulnerable as you could be in Israel. So vulnerable that there is no way she could have stood up to Manasseh's power and his strength. This, the spirit of Manasseh, continues on in King Herod. And the Gospel of Matthew tells us that Herod was just as committed to Manasseh's violence against innocent life, though it wasn't a young woman who lost her life by Herod, but all of the babies in the town of Bethlehem. When I think of Manasseh, when I think of Herod, my imagination, my unformed imagination, can only come up with one answer to how God makes the impossible possible and gets rid of Manasseh and gets rid of Herod. There's only one way to get rid of kings like this. Get a bigger power and overthrow them. And this is the place where Advent comes and messes with us every single year. Right? I mean, I read the words that the angel speaks to Mary. It says, the Holy Spirit will come upon you and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. And I think, yeah, here's the power that I'm talking about. But this power never shows itself as power, at least not the way that I think that it should. God doesn't do anything to Herod. And I think back to Manasseh. This is the most maddening thing about Manasseh. He reigns longer than any of Israel's kings. What? Like, so having the power to overthrow a king, God doesn't. Instead, God sends his spirit on a young woman. But even here, my small imagination is still hopeful because I've heard of some pretty amazing woman warriors. I don't know if you know this. My sister is a black belt in karate and was like a Marine. And even though I could still take her, I mean, she's pretty tough. And you got like Joan of Arc, and you've got like this super tough. Do you guys watch American Ninja Warrior? What's her name? A few of them. I only knew of one. There's a few. We've got all kinds of like tough women. Who's the best one?
Graf.
Yeah, nice. I'm not calling on you again. Candace knows who the American Ninja Warriors are. but instead, so here, my small, limited, bounded imagination says, God picks the weak, right? That we see that all through Scripture, but he picks the weak to make them powerful. But that's not the story that Luke tells. The story that Luke tells us is that God picks the weak in order to keep working through the weak. Mary, we're told, will gain something called status, but never for becoming powerful. Mary's status will always be rooted in her weakness, in her vulnerability. Mary is a servant. She does the Lord's will. Which means that through giving birth and raising a son, she gives birth to a kingdom that's marked by weakness, a kingdom whose king refuses to fight back when he could, but submits himself to the powers of the world. God's answer to the impossibility of Manasseh and Herod is not to overthrow them and replace them with a better king, because those kingdoms are all built on the same foundation of power, which means that those kingdoms can only ever produce the same sorts of things. God's answer is to build an altogether different kingdom, starting with a better foundation. And this is not a kingdom that's built on power, but on service. A kingdom that starts with Mary. She says, I will be the Lord's servant. As your word speaks, I will do that. Advent wants to train us to stop looking for powerful answers to our impossible obstacles. One of the things that becomes hard for us, or one of the places where we have to make sense of Jesus, is that Jesus came as a baby and he died. These are clear signs of weakness. But there's a way of thinking that sometimes leaks into the church that says, yeah, Jesus was a baby, he died. Those are like, yeah, I get it, those are weak. But when Jesus comes again, oh, he's gonna kick butt, he's gonna take names. We're talking the book of Revelation. We're talking Jesus is a warrior, he's riding a horse and his robe is dripped in blood. People whose imaginations can only answer the impossibility with answers of power always read a Revelation and assume that the blood on Jesus's robe is his enemies. Of course it's his enemies. Jesus is powerful. Except every single time that Jesus has appeared in the book of Revelation up to that point, he is described with his death. He is identified with his death. He's identified as the slaughtered lamb. So that what we actually see is Jesus riding in victorious, his victory achieved through his own blood, his own death, his own sacrifice. It's only when our imaginations have been transformed and power isn't our go-to answer for everything that we could possibly read that passage that way, that it is Jesus wearing the robe dripped in his own blood, the one who came in weakness, who died in weakness, who continues to be marked by his wounds, who says, I am the slaughtered lamb, and I continue to give my life for you. Do this in remembrance of me. We come to the table this morning to remember that our King is the one who identifies himself as the slaughtered lamb, the one who subjects himself to the powers of the world to say, this is going to seem impossible, but with God, nothing is possible. This morning we come to receive the bread and the cup, to remember his death, and to proclaim that today we wait for his return. And as we wait, we have been called to be witnesses. Witnesses of this kingdom, witnesses of this King, telling the world who our God is and what he is like.